I'm really honored to be here today to talk to you about security education. I'm going to start out by saying that I don't know everything about all aspects of education, so trying to be wise, I'm going to talk about what I know about rather than something else. So one of the challenges we have is that we need talented people in security today. The systems that we're using are vulnerable to attack, and as a consequence, there are a lot of people having to be defenders today. As you know, it's a rather asymmetric challenge. So in security education, there is a great demand now for operator types of people who can defend our networks. In the meantime, many of you here are in a more elite crowd who are working on new mechanisms to make systems more defensible, to find out what's wrong with them, et cetera. So we'll look for the need for talent. The problem of computer security and the need for education is not a new one. As soon as we had multi-programming on systems, there were people playing games with each other and fighting for core. And so back at MIT, they were playing Core Wars, and at that point, people started thinking about protecting systems from each other. In the military, the use of computers was burgeoning, and there were concerns about protecting very sensitive information and systems from attack and malicious software so that nuclear weapons, for example, weren't launched accidentally. We had various incidents, for example, the CIA activity with the logic bomb, where there was supposedly a subversion of the Trans-Siberian oil pipeline when they stole American software. And they had the American software problem as a result because they had a multi-megaton explosion when the pipeline software didn't behave as they expected it to. Apparently, this software had had a little bit of it, something extra added to it by the US. So there was an awareness of the need for security education even back in those old days, and then the Morris worm came along, and some schools started providing security education around this time. One of the first, for example, was Purdue. They started teaching classes there actually in the 80s. And the Naval Postgraduate School started in about 1990 at the behest of the National Security Agency. The agency has officers who come and have details there, and the officers were going into NSA not knowing how to spell security. And so NPS was asked to start teaching a class in computer security so that the students would, the officers would know about that. I think, though, that security education really got a big boost when we had Moonlight Maze. Here was an example of some suspects. We don't know exactly who, or if we do know, we'd have to shoot you if we told you. But there was exfiltration of very sensitive information out of a number of labs and government agencies. And at that point, people such as the National Security Advisor Richard Clark and others began to recognize that we needed to have an educated workforce in security, both in the federal sector and in the rest of the commercial community throughout the country. And then we've had various incidents since then, and I'm not going to go through all of these. You can look them up on the internet. But there were others, for example, just in 2008, we had the thumb drive incident, and obviously that was a case of somebody not recognized, not inadequate training had taken place with this person who picked up a thumb drive and just shoved it into their USB port and then infected zillions of military systems. I'm still not allowed to use thumb drives because of that. There are continuing problems with the systems as a result of all of these attacks. But it definitely introduces security education as a definite need within the various sectors of our economy. So we have a talent crisis in security these days. In the early stages of the information age, there were some computer science departments, and they were burgeoning, and it was very difficult for students even to get into computer science departments because everybody knew that they would have a job when they got out. This changed somewhat in the throughout the 1990s. People's parents discovered that there was outsourcing, and so they didn't encourage their young offspring to go into computer science, and so we had a drop in students in the STEM fields. And we've been recovering a little bit in computer science. People recognize this as an area, a growth area, and so we have lots more students, but today the talent problem is still very horrible. So this graph just shows that there's been an uptick in computer science over the past several years, and we can only hope that that continues. But the problem is, despite the output that is occurring in the computer science departments, the demand for people is still enormous. Now, we heard our keynote speaker yesterday, Dickie George, talking about various aspects of crypto, but on the side, he revealed that he needs 400 people in his organization. General Alexander at the National Security Agency, he's Dernza, the director, said that he wanted 400 people by the end of the year, and then several thousand after that, doing cyber. The commercial sector needs people. The education sector will need people to teach the people who are taking these positions. So the demand for talent is enormous at this point because it has been recognized that computer security and cybersecurity are essential to our economy and to the well-being of the United States. So we now live in a world where a nation's security depends in no small part on the security awareness and practices of our agencies, firms, suppliers, schools, friends, neighbors, relatives, and, well, all of us. And this is a quote from General Alexander, who still is the director of the NSA, made in 2010. So our education problem is not just a STEM problem. It's a problem associated with all levels of the population, from the kids who are playing on their computers to grandma and grandpa who want to go online and make their travel plans. So it's multidimensional. We have to teach basic hygiene on the internet, perhaps as part of civics for young people, starting at a very early age. We also need to make children aware of the fact that there are dangers on the internet that they need to avoid. And there are many organizations that are making some inroads in this. For example, the ITU had a year for childhood safety online. And this was a global effort to increase awareness for the safety of children online and to make them more aware of things they should and shouldn't do. But there are research activities that can also help to ensure child safety online as well and to educate them. But the research spectrum that we need to deal with ranges from hardware to the human-machine interface. And we need to educate home users, people at work. We need to educate policymakers so that they understand not to be asking us for anti-gravity machines and other technologies that we will be unable to produce. They also need to know not to ask us to boil the ocean. There are a number of things that are possible, but there are a lot of things that are completely impossible as well. We need to educate operators, and I will later on in this talk make a distinction between operators and people who really need more advanced education. And then we have our developers and our researchers who will need really concentrated, high-level education. So the question is, what sort of people are needed? And this has been a problem that has not been very well addressed until pretty recently. We have national-scale objectives where everybody needs to have some level of cybersecurity awareness and competence. But we also need to have a highly trained and educated workforce that can deal with the problem of agility and resilience in networks and able to respond to network situations and perhaps degraded situations in our networks. And so there's a focus in the federal sector at this point to determine what the workforce is and define that for the federal sector, understand what the job requirements are, and then to promulgate this out to other sectors so that we have better definitions of the types of people we need and so that we can distinguish one type of person from another type of person. So I'm talking a little bit about the workforce at this point because it's important to know what workforce you're dealing with in order to provide the education. It's a question of requirements elicitation. If you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there, to paraphrase the Cheshire Cat. We have awareness that is required. We need formal education. We need a workforce structure so that we know who we're educating and what for. And then we need training and professional development. This chart is derived from an initiative that is ongoing at the National Institute of Standards and Technology. There has been input from many sectors of the federal government, both the Department of Defense, the Department of Homeland Security, and other sectors, to define a workforce. So they have here the categories of things that people will specialize in, for example, provisioning the network, or analyzing it, or operating it, or doing collections, et cetera. And within those broad categories, then there are various job categories that allow us to specialize and have people who, for example, are good at incident response as opposed to people who may be doing network defense or people who are good at forensics. So this chart allows us to gain an understanding of the needs we have in the workforce. And one of the challenges that we have to do is differentiate between education and training as we look at this workforce situation. So once you have the workforce, where do you need formal education? Where do you need training and professional development? And where do you need awareness? And this differentiation will then determine the kinds of things that we're doing in terms of security education throughout the broad spectrum of the population. For example, in awareness, we want everybody to be aware if they've got a digital device, and practically everybody has something these days, of the types of things that they need to do to protect their information and to ensure that they're working with proper hygiene online. So people may learn at home, at school, they may have some training in the workplace, and they may also learn through various mass media. And I believe that people will learn through advertising, movies, et cetera, or even the newspapers. But the games, for example, that were discussed last night during the RUM session may help with some of this awareness training. If we move on to training, though, now there is a difference between training and education. In training, you are teaching somebody to do something repetitive, and they get very good at it, and they are able to redo this task over and over and over again. And so it doesn't require a lot of creativity and insight to have a trained individual. And training may be the most appropriate sort of education to provide for people who are operating the networks. And so we may look at high schools and community colleges to provide the kind of training we need for the operators of the systems. So you learn how to configure a router according to the policy provided by the enterprise, and you're trained to do that. And then when a new brand of router comes along, you go to router school and learn how to configure that router, and you're good to go. But you're not necessarily developing the next generation of routers. So there may be training courses by the vendors, for example, on how to use their products and how to insert them within your infrastructure. You may also have advanced training in the workplace provided by the enterprise, and it will require people to have practice. So you may devote several weeks a year for training for individuals. Then there's formal education. So this starts, I believe, in late high school. You can start having computer security woven into classes that are teaching basic computer science. We currently only have classes, I know this is changing, but the classes used to be you learn a programming language and take an AP exam. Well, it needs to be more than that these days. We can have workplace and entertainment providing some education and self-study. And in the area of self-study, a little bit later on in this talk, I'm going to talk about various cyber exercises, because I believe there is a large pool of autodidacts out there in computer security. Many of you, I guess we could take an informal poll right now, are probably autodidacts in this field. And a lot of what you've learned by fooling around. And I think that will continue. There's a kind of curiosity that we want to foster and have people try things out. So I'm going to focus largely on formal and informal education rather than training, because I don't know very much about training, and I'll let the speakers from the audience fill in the gaps there later on. So one of the things that we have to understand is, are we teaching constructive security? And I really am going to rant about this a little bit, because I feel like today what we are doing is defending our systems and finding out what the holes are in this product and that product without as much constructive security as we should be doing. And in the area of constructive security, I believe we also need to have ways of measuring how well we're doing. And that's a huge challenge, and I know that there are big initiatives right now to instill science into security. Now, whether that's possible or not remains to be seen. But we can look at structural engineering, perhaps, as an example, and let's hope that it doesn't take us 3,000 years to get there, or 4,000 years. So back, the first structural engineer to be recorded in history was Imhotep, who built the step pyramid in about 2500 BC. The Great Pyramid was built about 100 years after that. So there's pictures there's a picture of him there, the first structural engineer. Greek mathematics and Archimedes with the lever moved engineering forward. Then the Romans, they were really great at engineering, but a lot of their measurements were a little bit ad hoc. If you built a bridge, you stood under it while the troops marched over the bridge, and if it didn't fall down, it must have been a good bridge. And so you sort of ate your own dog food, essentially, back in those days. There were texts produced. There was an architecture book written that was translated and survived the Dark Ages. And cathedral building, I think, leaned on this quite a bit. But there were the Masons with their secret society, basically, who knew how to build cathedrals, and nobody else did. And there wasn't really a lot of science behind it, but they knew what they were doing. The Renaissance added the science to engineering. We had Leonardo, followed by Galileo, Hooke, and Newton, and then Euler and Bernoulli and lots of other people who provided us a basis for consistent measurement and understanding of how to build things. So today we know that we do not build the Golden Gate Bridge out of toothpicks, but rather we use materials that we test the strength of and know in advance that the bridge will hold up. So for constructive security, what we need to do is make security a first-class objective in the design and construction of systems, and then ensure that the system is supposed to do what it is intended to do and nothing more. So what does this mean? It means, one, you don't build in bugs, because that's something more. It's unspecified functionality. So how do we keep unspecified functionality out of a system? And then if you're worried about the supply chain problem, unspecified functionality may be subversion of the system. And so understanding how to build a system to meet its specifications and nothing more, I think remains a challenge. This addresses the security problem up front, and we may increase the work factor of various adversaries according to how much we put into this kind of constructive security. A challenge is that we don't know how to do this science-based engineering very well. And today, if you have a master security engineer, somebody who's been around and done it for a long time, they know it when they see it, but they don't know how to tell it to the next generation. So there's a big education problem here in terms of capturing what we know and how to do it. So a broad overview of some of the security topics that you might teach in constructive security would include networks and communication security. People need to know that because they're distributed systems. We need to know how to protect data, so you need data security classes. You need to have people understand foundational design principles for systems. You need to perhaps use formal methods in some cases. There'll be people who are cheering when they hear that. But formal methods are useful in helping us understand what's supposed to be in the system and to sort out what is supposed to be there and what's not. We need to engage in some protocol analysis. We need to look at things like model checking in that context, and you can use model checking against in the context of some of your formal methods. We need, at the start, to elicit the requirements for a system and have lifecycle management. If you state the requirements and then let any old person work on building the system without any quality control or cross-checking, who knows what's going to be in it? We also need to have systems that are not just self-documenting. And we use self-documenting systems now all the time. If you're in the open source movement, and who isn't, we use systems where it is what it is. You know, you download it, you look at the comments, and it does what it does, but there's no specification at a higher level saying this is what it's supposed to do. So this program is concerned with advanced persistent threats who put themselves into the systems. And if you're dealing with Trojan horses, then you may need to deal with multi-level security. And there were some talks here that sort of touched on multi-level security but didn't say those words. So it's always an issue. This is my eye chart, but at MPS we created a taxonomy of design principles that are taught in some of our classes to teach people about constructive security. And I'm not going to go into all of this, but we divided them up into how you structure the system, what the system does, and then how to build it on the far right-hand side. And as far as books and things, I like to remind people that we weren't so dumb 40 years ago. Von Donegan said that ancient astronauts had to have built the pyramids, but I think at this point we know that people weren't ignorant and that they actually knew how to build the pyramids. And so there are pyramids we can stand on, and these are just a few of the classic papers that I particularly like. I really like Dijkstra's THE paper, partly because it's got the bonus appendix, which is amazing. Semaphores were introduced as an appendix to this THE paper, which isn't very long. But there's a whole set of papers that allow you to understand what people knew back in the old days. A lot of the problems are the same. They've been translated to newer software and newer hardware. But they're often written in simpler terms in these papers. And so your students can understand where we were and where we are and how much we've done and how little we've done. Modern case studies can complement that. And I just put a little random sampling of some books that have been used over the years in various classes. And maybe we have one of the authors in the audience. I know we've got an author here. So the other problem that we have to do is to deal with reactive systems. So we need a constructive approach to security to increase the work factor. We need to have a significant initial investment. And some people will say, well, that costs too much. But then I think it would be useful if someone did a study to determine, does it really cost more to put it in at the beginning, and how much does it cost to not have it in later on? Work is needed on the usability of constructive systems. So I think the research topics that are being discussed here regarding usability are really important. In constructive systems, it might be more difficult to monitor them. So that may be a trade-off in terms of how to build them in. No system, no matter how perfectly constructed, will be perfect. Therefore, trans-global attacks are still attractive, and we need to have reactive security to complement constructive security. And in the reactive paradigm, the defense may require techniques that could be mistaken for attacks, because a lot of times you're doing the same thing, using the same kinds of tools for defense as someone might use for an attack. And we have to be very careful about what we teach. So I'm now going to segue into cyber operations, which is not constructive security. It is more of an operational flavor. You have the systems. They have been built. You may know something about how they're built and make some decisions about which components to put in. Yet the major focus is to defend systems or attack other people's systems. So this is relatively new. The NPS has been involved in a new effort that is being supported by the National Security Agency to become a center of excellence in cyber operations. Now, I'll talk about the other centers of excellence a little bit later on, but this started with an announcement last November that they were going to establish these, and they solicited inputs from various universities. Anyone can apply. And the motivation for this is to focus on cyber operations and to deal with the fact that the workforce just is inadequate to deal with the demand for people who know about this. So it was announced, and then in January we put in our applications. And we had to provide various evidence. And the criteria for becoming one of these centers of excellence in cyber operations are pretty steep. And I'm going to just show them to you, because I believe that the universities that are represented here in this audience ought to be thinking about this and stepping forward and becoming these centers of excellence. There's a great opportunity to have a really good time working on the problems associated with this cyber operations. So these are the types of things we have to provide in our curriculum to become a center of excellence in cyber operations. We need to have our students know low-level programming. Not only do they need to know C, they need to know assembly language. They need to know how to program at the Unix command line. They need to be able to read Unix man pages and or Linux man pages and do those command line operations. And a lot of computer science departments, you know, they're teaching stuff like Python. Well, you can't get down into the lower guts of a system just knowing Python. So this is a shift here to get down in the weeds in the system. Reverse engineering is another one of the topics. So you've learned your low-level programming. Now you're going to learn how to take a system apart and figure out what's in it. Well, obviously you don't want to break any laws doing this, but you do want to figure out what's there and what's going on with it. So you want to reverse engineer malware. You know, you've got to understand what happened. How was it compiled? What compiler was it compiled with? Can you attribute this malware to a particular place or a set of people because you know they use the XYZ Whatcom compiler or whatever? The various engineering tools and techniques that may be required for such reverse engineering need to be learned. We don't make the students buy the IDA Pro book and go through it all, but they do have some lessons from that kind of a context. And fortunately, I have a member of our faculty wrote the IDA Pro book, so it makes it pretty easy to get into the reverse engineering. You also need to reverse engineer computer communications protocols as they are implemented in some cases. Students, of course, need to know about networking. So they need to know basic networking, and they also need to know about security in networking. And we have a course in network traffic analysis, and it'll take on different flavors depending on who's teaching it. There's the big networks pipe people who are looking at performance, and there's the intrusion detection people, and then there are the forensic guys. And so the course has different aspects as different faculty members get in front of the students. They need to know about operating systems and the usual types of things about privilege escalation in systems and how privileges is meted out, concurrency and synchronization, process management, etc. So the list goes on there, and I'm not going to read it all to you. Another set of requirements have to do with math. So they wanted all of our students to have discrete math, statistics, automata, algorithms, calculus. They also wanted them, this is not a math bullet down there, the legal aspects. It's a standalone bullet. So all of these topics had to be covered in our curriculum. They want us to tell the students about telecommunications. So this is different than network security. Sometimes we use various satellites, et cetera, to communicate and provide the communications. So how does the telecommunications network work? And what technologies need to be in place for that? What is the core network infrastructure, for example, for mobile networks? And how does that differ from the core network infrastructure that you use for the internet? And how are they similar? Then they also said, by the way, these guys could have had a V8, and they could have been dealing with systems that were, in fact, constructed better in the first place. So maybe you ought to just, a requirement was to tell them about how systems could have been built more securely, even though they aren't necessarily well built. So these are among the same kinds of topics that we have back in the constructive security section. We then had to provide an overview of cyber defense, the techniques for cyber defense, cryptography, anomaly detection, malicious activity detection, et cetera, reconnaissance operations and identification, which you might do in defense, how people may exfiltrate information out of your systems. So there have been a lot of discussions, for example, of covert channels and side channels. Those are cool ways of getting information out, but there may be even more mundane things that happen in various network attacks. How you can identify malicious code in systems. How security architectures may affect your defensive techniques in systems. Relationships with regard to trust. Are you using various certificate chains, et cetera? Are systems dependent upon each other for security so that you're creating cycles in the systems? Virtualization, all the new technologies that are coming forth, the students need to know about, because if they're dealing with a cloud, they're going to have to defend it. In addition to all, those were the mandatory requirements. We also had to provide at least 60% of these topics to achieve our objectives with the Cyber Operations Centers of Excellence. So you can see there's something for everybody here. Your faculty can keep very busy with all these topics. Now, they don't have to be separate courses, but the topics that the program wanted to be covered are very broad and very interesting. And it's multidisciplinary in that your electrical engineering department and your computer engineering department will have a role to play, as well as your political science or legal law school may have courses to add to the mix. So the academic content was only one part of the requirements for this. You had to have a degree or certificates to achieve this. You had to either be accredited in some way or have a review by the NSA that you were in fact doing this. You had to treat it as an interdisciplinary activity and not just focus on the computer science department. You needed to show that you were actually doing it. So just because it's listed in the school's catalog, they really wanted to know that the course was being taught, and they're going to come back and check in a couple of years to make sure that the courses are being taught. This is not just a paper exercise. They wanted to make sure that the faculty was doing research in this area and that the students were going to be doing research and being active in the area. They wanted the students to also do community outreach or something like that to help broaden the scope of the activities to bring in and encourage other people to join the fray. They also are offering internships to students. So this is a great way for undergraduates to really have a good time in the summer. Instead of just going to be an intern someplace or flipping burgers, they get to go to the NSA and spend the summer there taking special boot camp courses. And your students need to be U.S. citizens to do this because they're going to give them a very rapid run through the clearance process and get them cleared. And then they get to go to NSA. This summer, they're having a boot camp where they taught 2 weeks of cyber operations, and then they taught a week of SCADA security, and right now they're teaching a reverse engineering class. That is being taught by our IDAPRO author, Chris Eagle, who just came off of running DEF CON, the Capture the Flag there. So it ought to be a good course. And their final requirement is that you need at least 2 faculty members involved in this, which seems hardly possible that only 2 faculty members can be involved with all the topics being covered. So they announced 4 schools involved in this, and I mean, look at these schools. We've got some of the top universities in the country sitting here in this audience. We can do better than this. Consider this as a possible activity for your school to fill in. It didn't take very long. It took a day to fill in all the forms and provide the information to them. They're going to support the faculty members as well. I got to go to one of the boot camp activities this summer. So there are opportunities for your students and collaboration with them. They've actually assigned somebody who's going to come out and work with us to make sure that our program is good. So just to prove to you that it's possible to do this, I'm going to show you the course activities that our students are going to be involved in order to achieve this cyber ops specialization. So you can see that they're very busy. And because I work at the Naval Postgraduate School and we're part of the Department of Defense, down at the bottom I have those 2 funny colored courses, or 3 of them. 2 of them are top secret and 1 of them is secret. Well, you just don't do cyber munitions out in the open if you're building cyber munitions, so that's a classified course. And the advanced topics course also could deal with things that are classified, so we made that a classified course as well. And some of the communications architectures used by the military are classified at the secret level, so we said, okay, we'll put that secret course. It already existed. We weren't going to reinvent it. As you can see, there are a lot of interesting courses in this mix. I'll talk a little bit about the cyber war game, which is over in the left-hand column a little bit later, but that is one of the cornerstones of the program. And then we have all these electives to help fill in that 60% that they were asking for, so students can take electives on various topics. And we have a less technical program for operators that we put together and launched last September. And we have two cohorts of students going through this. They don't get to have the fun boot camp and stuff in the summer with the NSA, but we have military officers involved in this. And just so you know, there are some courses in this mix which are called Joint Professional Military Education, and it's all about, you know, learning the art of war and things like that. It doesn't have anything to do with computer science or anything. It's how to be a military officer. But we have four courses of that plugged into this curriculum. But again, they have the cyber war game built into that curriculum. It is offered so that students from all over the school can be involved in the war game, which I will address in a couple of slides. This is for the operators, and the one above was for the people who are actually building things and doing the deep technical work. And this is somewhat less technical, and it's more operator-oriented. And the people taking this are the ones who are going to make decisions and boss people around. What about labs? You need labs. Practical experience is very important in computer security education. If you don't have a lab and you're not doing practical things, and real practical things, not just fake exercises, et cetera, your students aren't going to be able to do what is needed. Emphasis on laboratory activity is very important. Some of our classes are 2 hours of lecture and 5 hours of lab because that's what we feel is necessary for them to really get an understanding of the topic. The reverse engineering course has huge lab components in it, for example. So things that they can do in the labs. Starting at the top there, an example is how to think like an adversary. And you've got to think about threats in order to understand the security requirements. So this I picked up from the guys at West Point. What they did was give their students, tell them that they were having an exam tomorrow in which you were going to have to write down pi to 100 places. Does anybody here know pi to 100 places? No. All right. I knew somebody who did once. But they were told they could cheat. So they would fail the exam if they didn't write down pi to 100 places. They'd fail the exam if they were caught cheating, but they were told that they could cheat. Now, West Point has an honor code. Nobody's supposed to cheat. So this was antithetical to what they're really supposed to be doing. But the students were incredibly inventive in how they managed to sneak in pi to 100 places and get it written down on their exams. And it made them think about it. Now, Kobayashi Maru, we've all seen Star Trek, or some of us have, and Captain Kirk, young Captain Kirk, cheats the system, and he's on trial because he cheated the game. But really, you know, that's what you have to learn to do if you're going to be an adversary. So that's one of the things that you put into your curriculum. Do threat analysis. Understand what the requirements are. Do design and implementation. Maybe apply formal methods and model checking in the process of doing that. Learn about penetration testing and have labs on that. And then engage in various cyber exercises and war games. So finally, I'm at the cyber war game. So the centerpiece of our programs at NPS is a cyber war game that happens every 6 months. And unlike the capture the flag exercises that Baby canned and staged, the cyber war game involves the students in actually designing a war game. So the first part of the course involves selection of the scenario, deciding who's on the red team, who's on the blue team, splitting up the teams. And then after they have decided on their scenario, they decide on the rules of engagement. Because in most cyber war games today, the blue team, after the war game is over, the blue team comes in and says, nothing happened. Everything's fine. You know, we're great. And then the red team comes in and says, surprise, this happened, and you didn't know it. And so we don't want the blue team to lose all the time. And so you establish some rules of engagement and how points are awarded. so that the blue team people don't feel quite so bad. They divide up into their teams. The blue team is trying to build their scenario and build their system. You have to have requirements for them actually to talk to the rest of the world, because if they just hunker down and do their little internal thing, then it's really hard for the attackers to whack them. But if you have a realistic scenario, then they're going to have to communicate outside of their little enclave. In the meantime, the red team is trying to posit what the blue team may be up to and build their tools and do an analysis of the vulnerabilities of that setup. And we play the war game during the lab periods for about 2 weeks, and then after that they have an after-battle damage assessment. We have to have a different war game every time we do this so that the students can learn from previous war games. And the first time you play the war game, you're on the blue team, and then the second time you get to be on the red team. And so we've done this once, and our next war game will be in September. And this will be a continuing activity for the students at our institution. And so the objective is that they have to maintain a high state of readiness in systems that are degraded and under attack. And they need to provide resiliency. In some cases, your system may go down in the services that are provided, but if you can maintain some level of service and then be able to spring back from an attack and then provide more service, this will provide the students with mechanisms to be able to do that. Now, something completely different. I'm going to talk about opportunities for students who are U.S. citizens to obtain scholarships in cybersecurity. Just in case you don't know about these programs, you may want to tell your students about them. There are commitments associated with these particular scholarships, and the commitment may be that you have to work someplace in the federal sector after you graduate. By federal sector, that's been interpreted now to mean national laboratories, so you could go off to Sandia or PNNL. Or you could be working for the FBI or the Department of the Interior and helping Smokey the Bear, or the Department of Health, Education, you know, any of the departments. It doesn't really matter. In other cases, the scholarships are intended for students to move on to positions in the Department of Defense. But that does not mean that you have to, you know, get out a rifle and you know, put on a uniform or whatever and go to Afghanistan. You may choose to do that, but there are plenty of civilian positions over here where they're safe. And I've had many students where their parents come in and say, is my child going to be joining the Navy and have to go to Iraq? No, that's not the case. So here are the various programs. The National Science Foundation has a scholarship for service program. About 20 colleges and universities are currently participating in this. They will support students for 2 to 3 years in a master's or a bachelor's or a PhD program. The students have to be U.S. citizens and they need to be clearable. So this means that you have to have some reasonable expectation that they can get a secret clearance when they graduate, or top secret, which may be preferred by some agencies. The thing includes tuition, so they get their tuition paid for. They get a stipend, which depends on which degree they're working for. Master's students get $25,000 a year, which isn't a bad deal. So you're getting your tuition paid for, you're getting the stipend. They give them a book allowance, they give them a travel allowance. They pay a little bit for students to buy some health insurance. The program conducts a job fair to hook the students up with potential employers, and the students are expected to have paid summer internships. And so as part of the job fair, they also help students hook up with various internship opportunities in the federal sector. And the payback is commensurate with however many years you've put into the program. And so students have gone off to a wide variety of agencies. And we've had students who have interned at the White House, for example, and then gotten jobs at NSA or the FBI or the CIA or the National Lab. So this is a really great opportunity. There are opportunities in the Department of Defense with a program called SMART. These have involved a lot of colleges, and they will support students in bachelor's, master's, and PhD programs. Again, there's a stipend, there's a tuition, and other educational expenses, and the payback is to be placed in a civilian job in the Department of Defense. The National or the Department of Defense labs are particularly looking for graduates of the SMART program. So you might go to the Air Force Research Lab or the Navy Research Lab after getting a degree in this. This program is not just focused on cybersecurity, but includes all of the STEM fields. So you might pass this on to other departments in your school that they're looking for mechanical engineers and structural engineers, as well as computer people, and physicists and chemists, et cetera. Then the Department of Defense also has a program called IASP, Information Assurance Scholarship Program. They have two aspects to this. One is to retain people within the Department of Defense, and the other is to bring new people in. And so they've got any of 100 schools right now can apply for this. This is their National Centers of Academic Excellence. The qualifications are, again, to be U.S. citizens who are clearable, and the students get stipends and tuition for this. The payback is to take civilian jobs in the Department of Defense. Looking to the future, how are we going to get people involved in cybersecurity and increase our education? One thing that may be useful is a good TV show. So I understand that NCIS is the most popular show on television. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't have a TV. I don't know. And I think it's about Navy guys doing criminal investigations. In any case, apparently a lot of young people have gone into forensics after watching this show. There's a huge, they think it's a glamorous field. So what we need, is to have a glamorous cyber security and operations TV show. I don't know who you get to be in it, but I think that there could, just think of all the weird and wonderful problems that could be solved on this show, where you have the geeky people working with the movie stars. It can't hurt. If you've got an idea for a TV show, I live in the Monterey Peninsula, and Clint Eastwood used to be the mayor of Carmel, so maybe we'll find a connection. There are only 6 degrees of separation. So other things, though, are new modalities, YouTube videos, the Khan Academy. Has anybody used the Khan Academy in their classes? I have. Why should I talk about causality when they do such a good job? I just show this 6-minute talk to my students, and they suddenly, the lights go on, you know, that you don't necessarily believe everything you see in the newspaper. Games. So we saw some social games last night, tabletop games of various sorts. NPS has a game called Cyber Siege, which if we have a couple minutes, I can give you a little demo of. It's a video game for teaching computer security, in which your job is to be the system administrator and put in things and deal with buying resources to protect the system while the rest of the company is trying to get work done. Maybe various forms of massive online learning can be included in this. I believe that the protests that we've been having with these Occupy movements, a lot of it has to do with student debt. And so maybe this new form of learning will help relieve some of that problem. Education has to change. The debt problem of students and their families is just getting too high. So maybe there are ways to use this massive online learning courses to bring people up to speed. But we can use cyber exercises as well. The benefits are that cyber exercises are cool and challenging. They're often competitive, they're team sports, and people can test themselves. So how do we use cyber exercises? So I had a number of conversations with Chris about this. And if we were to design a cyber exercise so that you had puzzles and things that qualified you to compete in the exercise, and these do happen in some of the big exercises, then the students will be learn what they still need to know. So if you have a puzzle that the student has to solve that requires them to understand certain aspects of automata, algorithms, or compilers, then they can be told, well, maybe you didn't get this puzzle right, but go back and study this, or take this massive online learning class, and then come back and try the exercise again in 6 months or a year. And so by doing that and providing good mentoring, allowing people to see the old puzzles and work through them, I think we could improve education in that way and have more autodidactic learning. Because right now, if you've got somebody, a high school student, who is really interested in computers and security and et cetera, and you sit them down in a class where somebody's teaching them elementary Python, how long is this going to last before they're just, you know, throwing up their hands and saying, I don't want to do this, I don't want to be involved? We have to have things that get people involved, that have graduated sets of difficulties so that nobody feels bad about taking time and learning things, but that allows curiosity to be satisfied and move students to more and more complex challenges and to make it cool to be really good at some of these things. So as education, you can use, for example, cyber exercises as a springboard, but you need to require that the exercises need educated people by making the exercises themselves require certain aspects of computer science and computer security education to complete the exercise with progressively more difficult problems. Well, some words of warning. There has been an emphasis in some aspects of the cybersecurity education world on standards. I talked a little bit earlier about the 100, there are actually about 175 centers of academic excellence in cybersecurity or information security education. Well, Gene Spafford calls these centers of adequacy. Because the standards were written by bureaucrats, and they're largely training standards, and it's a bunch of check-the-box stuff, and it doesn't really mean excellent. It means you did these things. And so we have a lot of standards and requirements for education that have been designed by committees. For example, we have a requirement from FISMA that people get certain certificates, CISSP. So what do? You go to a two-week SANS class or something like that, and you then take the CISSP class, and then somehow you're a wonderful network security person. That's not really enough. And so it's going to be up to the education community to raise the bar on some of this to ensure that the people who are being taught are getting what they want, and that we have education standards rather than training standards as part of the mix. So the proof of the pudding is in the eating, as they used to say. You know, you don't know if the pudding's good until you put it in your mouth. So we need to produce students who get great jobs. And industry needs to be involved in helping us establish these standards and understand the difference between an operator who could take these training exams and do this training stuff and people who are going to creatively create the new networks and systems that we need for tomorrow. So there are all kinds of resources available. I'd like to point out IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. There's an education column there, also we are always soliciting authors for that. So there's opportunities in the education column. The National Science Foundation, their Division of Undergraduate Education, has a number of programs, including the Scholarship for Service program, My Video Game. Local service organizations may help you with awareness, for example, and they may want to help reach out to schools, et cetera. And you can start programs for your students to reach out and do community service. There is the workshop on the National Initiative for Cybersecurity Education, which will occur in October at the National Institutes for Standards and Technology in Gaithersburg, Maryland, in October. So you still have time to look at that and sign up for it. This is just a random list of some of the things that you might want to look at. So that's the end, and I'm ready to go on to some questions.
Hi, really enjoyed that talk and the Cyber Operation Center of Excellence designation. Seems it's a lot of work for universities to go through. What would be the benefit of getting that designation?
Well, one benefit is that if you get that designation, they are actually clearing the faculty members too. And you will have access to super secret information of cool things that are happening in the places like the National Security Agency. And I can guarantee you that there is some extremely interesting work being done.
So I assume there's no additional funding that goes with that? Is that the idea? I mean, there's not funding tied to that.
Probably there's not a huge amount of funding. Okay. They may pay for some travel costs for you, but they're very supportive. And for example, for the summer workshops, they'll bring the faculty members out to participate in that.
Okay, thank you.
Cynthia, great talk.
Thank you.
A couple of additional things, not so much a question, but for people in the audience who aren't familiar, I mentioned last night the Secure and Trustworthy Cyberspace program has education grants for curriculum development. That's one of the things we have. I don't know how well that can be married with some of the things you've talked about, but it might be worth looking into. We hadn't really considered that. And the other thing is, in addition to the scholarship opportunities you mentioned, there's also a number of private scholarships. Taking off my NSF hat, the Applied Computer Security Associates offers, for example, the Scholarship for Women Studying Information Security, SWIS, which is for upper-level undergraduate and beginning graduate students. And if anyone's interested in that, check the AXA webpage or give me a shout.
Going back to earlier when you were talking about the need for emerging professionals in this field to have a security knowledge throughout, I mean, you talked about the Naval Academy, obviously, your graduate program, but also as we think about undergraduates, their need to have security knowledge from the very beginning. How do you see universities transitioning to this? Because as you mentioned, it needs to be in every class, security is there, so it's not this tacked on thing they do at the end of whatever project they're doing. How do you see faculty becoming trained enough so that all faculty understand security enough that they can be teaching at every level of coursework?
That is a challenge. There's been a lot of discussion of how security might be integrated into existing classes, because if you're dealing with the requirements, say, of the ACM curriculum or an ABET curriculum, security isn't necessarily something that you have room to add a lot on with. So, for example, if you have a course on programming, you may have a programming problem that involves some security exercise or construct that the students have to think about. When I first started teaching at MPS, the operating systems class people said, well, you're going to talk about the security in the operating system, so we won't touch it at all in the OS class. And I said, no, don't do that. I can become more advanced if you teach the basics. So a lot of what happens in operating systems has to do with protection. I mean, process isolation and domain separation, et cetera, can be taught in an OS class. What needs to be done is that the students need to understand that these concepts play out in things like the cloud and the hypervisors, et cetera, that we're building today that they're depending upon to separate their information from somebody else's. And so building that in, everybody teaches networking now pretty much at the undergraduate level. And protection of networking can be worked into the class as well. So I think you can work with your faculty to integrate some of these topics in, or have labs that integrate them.
Alan Sherman, UMBC. I would like to hear more about Cyber Siege. And as part of your answer, how have you evaluated the effectiveness of this educational game?
Ah, well, he asked the right question. Cyber Siege is a video game that teaches people how to protect a network. And so this is an example. This is a beginning scenario. You are a trainer at BortSoft, and there's a new guy on the staff. He's been filled up with all kinds of information all day. And there's one thing that you can tell him before he leaves work. So you press OK to begin. Let's see if I can get out of this. I can't even see it all. Here we are at BortSoft with this new employee. That's supposed to be above his head, but in any case, we start the game, and it tells you everything that you're supposed to do. This is a very canned instance of the game. He's about to make a big mistake with his situation. We're not seeing the whole screen here, but he's going to get a worm, so it tells you what you did wrong, and then the game proceeds on, and what you have to do is go get him some training to beware of email attachments, and this costs you a little bit of money. It's a game that involves money. And so then we go along, and it tells you that you get an attaboy for doing this. There's an encyclopedia involved. And then later on, the viruses get cleared up magically in this particular case. You don't have to worry about that. But he gets an attachment named memo.doc from a coworker. Should he open it, yes or no? If you type no, well, this particular memo is telling him to come to the staff meeting. He gets fired, and that's the end of the game. So it also tells you that you need to beware, but some email attachments you do need to open. So this is a really simple scenario in the game. We have very complicated scenarios where we'll have a campaign of three or four scenarios that people have to play. We also have a scenario building tool, so you can create your own scenarios. There's an artificial intelligence engine underneath that provides all the evil stuff that's happening. And so we have scenarios, for example, on identity management, where somebody is a secret operative and they go into an internet cafe in some foreign country. Little known to them, there's a keylogger in the system, and they're being caught. Things like that can be part of Cyber Siege. So it's lots of fun. It's free. You could download it. You just go to our site. You can look up Cyber Siege on Google. And we'll send you a key, and you can download the full game. It also comes with movies. And so you can play movies in class without ever having to make anybody play the game. And you can put the game on a server, or you can just have people play it on their own machines. For me, for some reason, my machine doesn't like to play this. More people have a better time with it than I do. It has a wide spectrum of activity, and we have users all over the world. They play it in Ulaanbaatar. We have from Mongolia to Afghanistan, they're playing Cyber Siege. So take advantage of it. It's free. Okay?
Steve Bellevin, Columbia University. I enjoyed your talk.
Oh, you have another question.
There was a second part of the question. How have you evaluated the effectiveness of this game?
Evaluating the effectiveness, we've got a proposal in to the National Science Foundation to have some psychologists help us do that, because we're not good at people evaluation. We don't have a psychology department or an education department. So we're working with another university and getting its effectiveness evaluated. And you have to have control groups, et cetera, to understand, you know, and do real science to evaluate its effectiveness. It's cool and it's fun, and a lot of educators are using it as part of their classes, but is it working? I don't know. We really don't know yet.
I very much enjoyed the talk. I especially like the stress on education versus training. That's one of my pet peeves about a lot of the security education. I want to make one observation and ask a question. Observation is that, you know, at least in my department, about 95% of the master's students are non-U.S. citizens, and hence a lot of this doesn't apply. And I believe that that's the case at many other major universities. A substantial portion of the PhD students and most of the master's students, overwhelming majority of the master's students, are not U.S. citizens, which makes a lot of this stuff not particularly... Well, I can't get them into scholarships of the NSA for good and sufficient reason. Question I have, though, is how do I teach security to the application developers, and especially the web developers? They're the ones who are causing the problems. It's great to have security specialists. I love it. It's what I do also, of course, but... You know, the problems are not generally in the crypto modules or in the firewalls. They're in the PHP scripts and the word processors and so on. What do we do about this?
I'm not entirely sure what to do about it. We don't have that many courses on application development. It's not an emphasis in our department. I would say that perhaps those courses, I'm just speculating, should have, in addition to laying out the requirements and doing some good software engineering, goes a long way in terms of building more robust systems, but to do a threat analysis as part of the high-level design of the system before it's built. And that if these application developers did a threat analysis in advance, that they would have at least a better awareness that there might be security problems in what they're building, rather than just letting the code, you know, fly off their fingers from something that they've cooked up in their heads without thinking about the problem of an intelligent adversary coming after their system. I think a lot of what happens in software development is that they do not recognize that there's an intelligent adversary. That is part of the problem that they have to address.
Okay, thanks.
Sandy Clark, University of Pennsylvania. I just wanted to put in another plug for the Lessons from the Kobayashi Maru. If you want to see this actual talk on getting kids to cheat and how creatively they did it, it's available on shmoocon.org/presentations. And it's interesting for two reasons. First, how they had to get to break the psychological barriers against cheating in these really bright but good kids who are fundamentally obedient. And then when they did break these barriers, how really good at it they were. So.
Marcel Simon from J&J. And so a comment to Steve's question. Perhaps what's useful here is some sort of security minor that can get attached to general, you know, computer science that perhaps we in the private sector can ask application developers to take or to make sure they take before we can give them a job. Which leads to my question. So how do we in the private sector fit into this vision and this activity?
Well, good case studies would be very useful, but I'm not sure whether you would want to reveal them.
Well, I mean, In the private sector, what we've got, as everybody knows, is, you know, there's extreme pressures to cut back IT costs. So, someone's got a three-week Java course certificate, and, you know, bingo, please come write my website for me, okay? And problems like that. And those folks don't know how to spell security. So the choice that we have is either to invest into security folks who can then kind of hover over these guys and make sure that they don't do something too wretched, or push back against the corporation to invest more into application developers, which is, that's swimming against the tide, as you might imagine. So that's kind of what I'm asking. I'm looking for ideas.
Well, I don't think pushing back against the corporation will necessarily work, because then you're pushing back against the stockholders, and the way corporations are structured these days, that's not going to work. The TV show. You need general public awareness that it is unsafe, and maybe then external demand will help to influence how well various systems are built. And if there were some way of then saying, using this software is safer than using that software, then you could have comparisons between the companies, and people might choose to use one implementation against another because they have a belief that their information will be better protected. I think as a girl, I saw a lot of pictures of windshields with heads that, well, the head part wasn't there, but holes in windshields from car crashes that happened on Friday night, you know, Sunday morning or Saturday morning, you'd see these things in the paper. And finally, safety glass became part of the way cars are built, and people's heads did not go through the windshield, and, you know, with the consequences of a massive bleeding. I mean, they still may have been killed, but not by having their heads and necks chopped off. So I think some public awareness may help. But here's somebody from a corporation who may have some suggestions too.
Yeah, Gurney Hunt, IBM Research. In terms of the application developer issue, have you considered integrating into the curricula the use of the tooling that's being developed by various companies to check out applications and identify the security flaws, et cetera, et cetera? There's a lot of stuff out there that's aimed at the fact that not all application developers know what they're doing, and you can write static and dynamic analysis tools to review code and check it and flag issues, and that seems to be very helpful in lowering the amount of exposure you have. The base principles that you need, those tools don't replace that. I mean, you can't replace good design and engineering, just like you can't bolt security onto either an operating system or an application after the fact. But I didn't see that necessarily in your curricula, but have you considered that sort of stuff?
Oh, yes. Yeah, tools, definitely. I was talking about some basics, but yes, you want to use modern tools so that the students are aware of those, and no matter what level they graduate into in the job market, either they expect to use those tools and ask for them, or they make sure that the people they're supervising are using such tools. So exposure to that is, I think, very important.
Great.
Thank you.